You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 16th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Michelle Goldberg, author, senior contributing writer for The Daily Beast and Newsweek. She's author of the book Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. And it has risen. Not just he has risen, but she has risen too. Both Bachman and Perry. Christian dominionists. What does that mean for you? Well, I don't know, what's the equivalent of a Christian burqa? If they become president, we will all be subject to the Old Testament. Hopefully we'll be talking to Michelle Goldberg live from Britain, where she is right now, perhaps on unrelated events. Also on the program, the anonymous protest in San Francisco. That other shoe has dropped for News Corp. Unions boycotting the DNC next year, the Democratic National Convention. That and more. First off, folks, a programming note. If you're watching the Sammy Cam, you can see that I am actually well-dressed today. You know, when we started the show, I was dressing nicer every day, and it's just I cannot maintain it. But when I go and do little TV spots, I dress up. And so just a programming note, if you can go back in time, you can watch me on CNN this morning. I forgot to tell anybody. Sorry. It wasn't that exciting. You know, they give you like 30 seconds. And that's why I'm wearing a tie. I should also tell you folks that today is August 16th. We are now in our 10th month. Tomorrow will be our 10th month of hard launch anniversary.
Huh. Just flew by.
The time just flew by, which means that soon my landlord will be sending me a renewal lease, which means that I'm going to have to do some hard, make some hard decisions over the next month or so. I've mentioned in the past, I'm a little bit behind projections in terms of members. Oddly enough, in terms of listeners, not behind projections. Slightly ahead of projections. So you see what I'm saying here? There is a disparity between my projections of listenership and how many of you would become members. Now, listen. I know times are difficult. Cable bills going through the roof. Utilities. I am no longer a consumer of such things, but I imagine recreational drugs also expensive, beer, alcohol, kids, they're all very expensive. If you cannot afford a membership to this program, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will work something out. No one has been turned away. And I don't have anyone's firstborn child. So you can see that I don't drive that hard of a bargain. But if you can afford 50 cents a day to support this show, I need your support to continue. Not only are you supporting the 40-minute free show that you get on a daily basis, not only will you get that extra 50 minutes, which, you know, sometimes some people say, last week, for instance, people were writing me going, I want to double my membership because of the quality of the members only show. Most of them said, but I can't. Understandable. But frankly, you know, you keep me in this business. And, you know, when I go into the green room, when I talk to producers at these shows, you would be disturbed at what some of their belief systems are. And not only beliefs, just the facts that they have wrong. And with maturity and some measure of economic desperation, I don't come back and I tell you all those stories because I don't want to screw myself. I have screwed myself with far too many people in a position to hire me to do that, despite my intense desire to constantly bite the hand that feeds me. You people are the only people whose hands I do not bite. And you should wear that with some pride. But please, go to Majority FM. Majority.fm, I should say. Become a member. You get some swag. You make sure that the show continues. For those of you who are new listeners, because we seem to be growing at an exponential rate these days, listen to the show for a couple more weeks. See if you like it. See if you would be feel like you'd be missing something if the show didn't exist. And then if you can afford the 50 cents a day, $10 a month, for this program, by all means, become a member. At the very least, I appreciate your buying the junk that you buy on Amazon through our link, buying Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. It's great coffee, fair trade, organic, coffee, tea, and chocolate. You get a 10% discount. That's like a win-win-win-win. And, of course, if you can donate your account, .com, always helpful. But, please, it's your membership that's going to keep this show at the end of the day. It's your membership that's going to keep this show alive. Now we're going to take a break. Hopefully we'll be able to reach Michelle Goldberg. Talk about these Dominionists. I'm not spending a lot of time talking about the Republican candidates these days, although somebody in Mitt Romney's office has been very, very busy with all their Oppo research, because I can't seem to take a step without reading more about how horrible Rick Perry is. And of course, then he's also threatening to hang the chairman of the Fed. I'm not so pleased with that guy either, but, you know, to reject the idea that monetary policy should be a tool to fight a financial crisis seems bat crap crazy. But I'm afraid Michelle Goldberg is going to come on to our program in a moment and tell us about things that are even would make Batcrap say, hey, wow, that is crazy. We'll be right back after this. We are back on the phone. Michelle Goldberg, she's an author and a senior contributing writer for the Daily Beast and Newsweek. She is the author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. You may have read her stuff in Glamour or Rolling Stone, The Nation, The Guardian, The New Republic. She's all over the place. And folks, her book, if you haven't read it, and I get, I have to admit, it's been a while for me, but more pertinent than ever, because I will say they have risen. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So first off, tell us, what is Christian Dominionism?
Okay, basically, Dominionism is a political ideology within certain strains of fundamentalist Christianity that basically holds that Christians have a right and an obligation to rule every sphere of earthly life. And so, the theological justification is that although, you know, God gave man dominion over the earth, it was removed when Adam and Eve were ejected from the Garden of Eden, but restored with the coming of Jesus Christ, at least to those who've been, you know, who are Christians. And so it essentially holds that Christians have dominion over the earth and have an obligation to exercise it. The way that manifests itself in our political life is that it kind of holds that there is and there really can be no separation of church and state, and that in fact it's kind of almost sacrilegious to have people who aren't Christian or who aren't the right kind of Christian controlling our government.
So wait, let's back up here for a moment, because you know, I don't know that much about Christianity, but I always remember that the quotes. Somebody said, "Leave unto Caesar that which is Caesar's." And what you seem to be saying is that not only do they not leave it unto Caesar, but what you're describing says that these people who subscribe to this, I don't know if I would call it a theology or a theory, I guess, that they actually have dominion over the world, over God even.
I don't know if it's so much that they have dominion over God as much as they see themselves as kind of God's unquestioned representatives on earth. The reason that I called it, you know, Christian nationalism in my book, and then I think dominionism is an idea that more people should be aware of because it's come to play such a big role in the Republican Party. You know, it's kind of incredibly significant in the backgrounds of Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry. But I think it's important to understand it as something separate from Christianity. I think to call it, you know, Christianity is a slander against many Christians. It's a very specific kind of nationalist political ideology that wraps itself in Christianity, and it might be a variant of fundamentalist Christianity, but it's primarily a political idea. And when you talk about, you know, render unto God what is God's and unto Caesar what is Caesar's, I think they've twisted that to a certain extent, so that, for example, you know, Michelle Bachmann, when she was in this video about the dangers of socialism that was produced by a very openly kind of dominionist church called Coral Ridge Ministries, since changed its name to Truth and Action Ministries, she repeated an idea that's very common in this world, which is that because Christians are called to tithe 10% of their income to the church, if you are made to give more than 10% of your income to the state, you're essentially putting Caesar above God.
Mm. Interesting. And so, all right, well, let's back up just a little bit here. So from what you're describing, these people are more akin to Christianists, if you will. I mean, when many on the right say that Islam is not a religion, it's a political ideology, in some ways, that's exactly what dominionism is.
Yeah, and I think that's a decent analogy. I mean, it's certainly true that there's far less terrorism among dominionists and Christian Reconstructionists than there are among Islamists, although there is some, but certainly far less.
Well, to be fair, there's also less of them.
Right, that's true. But I think just kind of ideologically, it's a decent analogy. And just as kind of one of the founding texts or one of the founding authors of political Islamism is Saeed Qutb, who basically extrapolated from his reading of the Quran this incredibly detailed schema that purports to guide every single aspect of life. A guy named R.J. Rush Juni, who I wrote about in both my book and my article, I think played a similar role in elaborating this ideology with his books, Institutes of Biblical Law.
And this is the guy, this guy Rush Juni, he was sort of the pioneer of the whole Christian homeschooling movement. Was he the one who, I mean, how did this sort of strain of dominionism land? How is it mixed with Republican politics? I mean, is it just so happens, okay, it is the Republican Party is a more hospitable home for this, or has there been actual sort of like coordination or an attempt by political operatives in the Republican Party to leverage this Christian dominionism to bring it into Republican politics?
Well, I think that, you know, well, if you want to start with kind of how it came about, you know, R.J. Rush Juni created this ideology called Christian Reconstructionism, which is absolutely the most severe and fanatical form of dominionism, you know, and it's a very small movement because even the most conservative Christians generally balk at, say, imposing the death penalty for homosexuality or apostasy or children who are excessively disobedient, as R.J. Rush Juni does. Mm. But although he's very extreme and there's very, very few people who want to put his ideas into action, his kind of the broader ideological framework that he's created was very, very influential, you know, not just in the creation of the homeschooling movement. He was the first to create this sort of revisionist American history that tried to present America as a fundamentally Christian nation, that reinterpreted the Civil War as a war between the Christian South and the godless North. He also, though, created this whole way of thinking that was then very influential on a guy named Francis Schaeffer, this kind of worldview thinking, which basically holds that Christianity is a total system of truth. It tells you everything you need to know about science, about history, about economics, and that any kind of discipline or any way of thinking that comes from outside of this system, because it's based on false premises, it can't be trusted. And so it's important to kind of grasp this concept because it helps you to understand the richness of the alternative reality that so many on the right have constructed. You know, when you hear, for example, that
Michelle, you've just described a cult. I mean, the notion, I mean, almost definitionally speaking, the idea that any information that comes from outside based on any other premise, you know, we have a basic assumption and everything follows from that. That's essentially how cults maintain their domination over their followers.
Well, it's one way. I mean, I think that there's elements of cultishness. There's probably, you know, there's things that are, you know, cults do other things as well in terms of kind of cutting people off from their friends and families. And, you know, there's other ways that they maintain control. But certainly, yeah, it's a totalizing political system that is incredibly hard to penetrate because it, you know, kind of makes itself impervious to challenges. And I think initially the Republican Party, you know, thought that it could, and well, correctly saw that it could, you know, manipulate this. I mean, when you have people indoctrinated into such a kind of total ideology with such a Manichaean view of good and evil, that's a very powerful political tool. And so, you know, so not only on the one hand, the movement was very keen on getting involved in politics and kind of taking over politics from the grassroots up. And, you know, they wrote quite, you know, there's fairly detailed writings about how you can literally, I mean, they talked about, you know, infiltrating the system and kind of, you know, it was almost a sort of long march through the institutions type of approach to politics. At the same time, you had a Republican Party that thought it could kind of manipulate these people, or if not, you know, and co-opt them. And I think that what you're seeing now is that the, you know, they kind of have a tiger by the tail. It's no longer the Republican Party. You know, the Republican Party can no longer kind of control this political, or Republican elites can no longer control this political Frankenstein. You know, now this movement and the movement and the party have become almost inseparable. And two of the three leading candidates for president are very, very closely associated with it.
It's stunning because we've traveled in the course of 30 some odd years at this point from people who were, I guess, in a very sort of generically way to put it, were very religious Christian who saw politics as profane, to now seeing politics as the culmination and the sort of the I guess the culmination of their religious beliefs. I mean, what do you have a sense of what really accounted? I mean, almost like on a more granular level, what accounted for that shift?
Well, look, you had, you know, part of it is that you had the rise of the evangelical movement in the mid-1970s that was part of a broader kind of spiritual upheaval in American life. And initially, it wasn't that political. You know, that's why it's not really surprising that the first campaign Michelle Bachmann ever worked on was Jimmy Carter. That was most evangelicals' introduction into politics. You know, a whole generation got kind of mobilized to elect one of their own to the presidency.
Right. I think people forget that Jimmy Carter was a reborn Christian, yes?
Yeah, he was a born-again Christian. People were very excited about that. A couple of things happened in the late 70s. I mean, on the one hand, there was a very deliberate attempt to create, you know, the moral majority and kind of enlist these new cadres into the Republican Party. There was a huge backlash against the Carter administration. The IRS during the Carter administration removed the tax-exempt status for a lot of the Christian academies that had been created in the South in response to Brown versus Board of Education. It was a way to kind of continue segregation under the guise of parochial education. And so people were really furious when, you know, and Randall Bulmer, who's a professor, who's an evangelical, but also a history professor at Columbia, has written that that was what the real spark of the modern Christian right. And then there was the anti-abortion movement and, you know, the sense that abortion kind of symbolized what people saw as this social breakdown of the 60s and 70s. So those three things were a very, very powerful force. You know, the movement set out, I think, very successfully and, you know, legitimately. I wish liberals had done the same thing, to get involved in politics from the grassroots up. You know, it's no accident that both Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin entered politics at the very, very local level. You know, Bachmann by running for school board, Sarah Palin by running for town council. You know, these were kind of classic Christian right strategies to take over the Republican Party from the grassroots. I think now that takeover has reached a point where they are the Republican Party. And so, you know, even like someone like George Bush, who was a very conservative evangelical and who I thought, you know, was very disrespectful of church and state, he wasn't wholly a product of this movement. You know, he had at least one foot in another kind of classically pro-business Republicanism. You know, I thought it was alarming that he had one advisor who was very close to Christian Reconstructionism. You know, now we have candidates who are kind of much more wholly of this movement.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to liberals, you know, it's, you know, the conservatives, they got into politics on that level, you know, because God told them to do it. You know, it's, you know, for a liberal, it's just basically somebody, you know, maybe you read Howard Zinn. It's not God coming down and saying.
Well, it's not your pastor. I mean, one of the right. things that I think that they have going for them is that liberals used to have a base of organizing in unions. It was something that brought people together. It was, you know, kind of a pre-existing organization that could be put to political use. I don't think they have anything comparable to the political organizations of modern churches, and particularly modern megachurches.
And so tell me about the concept. I mean, I know that this concept exists in some of this, and you talk about the idea of Dominionists wanting to infiltrate. Are they okay with essentially lying and hiding their agenda as they go forward? I mean, how explicit do they have to be to remain good Christian Dominionists as they are trying to obtain power in service of the Lord?
Well, I would say, for the most part, they are pretty honest about what they're up to. I mean, you know, a lot of the quotes that I use in my article, my book, are, you know, things that they wrote or things that they've said in speeches that were, you know, relatively open to the public. So, you know, they're often pretty clear about what they intend to do. I think that, you know, now you have, say, you know, Bachman or Perry running for president, they're obviously going to be a little bit more circumspect, although I don't really see them denying any of this. You know, what Bachman keeps saying is, well, that's not what people are interested in, or that's not why I'm running for president. But I haven't seen her really.
But what about that? What about that question in the debate where she's asked about her quote about being submissive to her husband? And she, I mean, to me, I find it very hard to believe that when she said those words about, you know, that I'm submissive to my husband and Marcus told me to run and to get a tax degree or become an attorney, I did it. I find it very hard to believe that when she said those words originally, which is not that long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, that she was talking about, we really respect each other. We have a mutual respect. We're both co-equals in this marriage.
Right.
I find that very hard to believe.
No, I think it's certainly more complicated than that. And nobody has really, I think that a lot of the commentary about this has really missed the point. I mean, the reason that this is relevant is because it's not because, you know, it matters whether or not he's forcing her to run. I mean, I think that's pretty clearly not true. But the question is, she's running to be the head of the state and she's admitted that he's the head of her. Well, then what is his role, you know, vis-a-vis the rest of us, you know, should she become president? So, yeah, I think that she's certainly, you're right, she's eliding or kind of trying to weasel out of the implications of some of her views. But, you know, I certainly
don't. I mean, if you say that you think that you as a woman, when you are married, your role is to be submissive to your husband, that is a window, it seems to me, into a broader worldview. And when she's asked about that and shuts that window, she's basically saying, like, I don't want you to look into this because this is just sort of like the part that you can see from the outside. I'm going to close the drapes on this so you don't realize, you know, exactly where I'm coming from. That to me seems like a very deliberate, conscious choice to hide this worldview she has. And it speaks to another point that she also feels quite confident that with those people who share that worldview, they already believe that she's one of them.
Right. Well, I guess my point is that I don't see her really lying. I see her refusing to talk about some of this stuff. I don't see her lying and pretending that she believes things that she doesn't, in fact, believe. You know, you do see her, even when you read the really great profile of her in The New Yorker recently, you know, she kind of shut down the conversation when it turned to these theological questions, and she ended the interview and she kind of refused to do any more because she wasn't comfortable with them. But I guess my point is that I don't think she's pretending to believe things that she doesn't believe. She just, you know, kind of knows that this message isn't going to play with the mainstream audience. And you're absolutely right, because she is so much of this movement, she really doesn't have anything to prove to the base. And so she can speak in, you know, kind of more reasonable seeming generalities to a mass audience.
Does Rick Perry have that same cred? In other words, will he have that same buy essentially with these Christian dominionists? I mean, can he go out there and say, oh yeah, my wife and I, we're, you know, it's a mutual relationship or whatever it is that he's going to be questioned on. Does he have that same cred that Michelle Bachman has?
I think close to it. You know, it's there's some people who, you know, he has his critics in Texas, and there's some people who, you know, I think Louis Gohmert and some other people have been saying, well, no, you can't really trust him. He's done a couple of things to anger this movement, like when he mandated the HPV vaccine in Texas.
Right. And has he backed off that now? I think I just saw something where he sort of backed off that now.
Right. But I guess my point is that he hasn't been as completely in lockstep, although, you know, pretty close. And so this huge rally that he just had, the response, you know, as the Texas Observer pointed out in its reporting, you know, dominionism, and I don't want to get too deep into the theological weeds, but it's a tendency that cuts across, you know, different denominations. And so he really has been in bed with a slightly different variant of dominionism. called the new Apostolic Reformation. And so it was basically a group, you know, kind of network of Dominionist organizations that were very, again, very open about their desire to kind of infiltrate and take over the institutions of earthly life, that worked with him on this big rally. And that, again, that have been open about seeing him as their vehicle to claim dominion over the United States government. You know, they've talked a lot about Texas being a prophet state that's going to, you know, lead to the re-Christianization, or as they see, the re-Christianization of the United States.
Wow. And finally, what are their perspectives on people who would count themselves as Dominionists? What are their perspectives on Mormonism? Because, you know, I think, you know, from Rick Perry's perspective, my sense was that, A, he was having that big evangelical prayer session, one, to sort of like solidify his bona fides amongst that community before he gets into the race, so it doesn't have quite the same amount of scrutiny nationally, and also to remind everybody, hey, I'm not a Mormon, and they're nuts, right? I mean, don't these people perceive Mormonism as a problem, or am I wrong about that?
I don't think they see Mormonism as nuts as much as maybe they see it as kind of evil. But yes, yeah, certainly they're not, you know, there's a long tradition of kind of what's sometimes called co-belligerency on the right. And so there's sometimes people who are willing to overlook theological differences in the name of, you know, kind of broader political objectives. You know, these groups also tend to see the Catholic Church as being, you know, the whore of Babylon, and, you know, in some of this theology, the Pope plays the role as of the Antichrist. I mean, that's certainly true of the kind of Lutheran offshoot church that Michelle Bachmann attended for a long time. And so, but so it's not necessarily that they're not willing to make alliances with Mormons, but I certainly think that, yes, there's, especially among the hardcore elements of this movement, they're certainly not comfortable with Mormonism.
And finally, let me just ask you, if a reporter says to Michelle Bachmann or to Rick Perry, as president, which trumps, man's law or God's law, what do they say?
You know, that's a good question. My guess would be that they would, you know, actually, I really don't know. My guess would be that they wouldn't answer it outright, and that they would try to find a way to finesse it, and that they would try to find a way to say that, you know, that kind of the laws of this country, when they're just, will always be consonant with God's laws. And so, you know, and so they're kind of, by definition, can't be a contradiction.
Interesting. All right. Well, Michelle Goldberg, thank you so much for spending time with us. Author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. And as far as I can tell, it's risen.
It's strange. A lot of the people I wrote about in that book, you know, have gotten a lot more powerful since then.
Well, I hope it wasn't because you wrote about them.
No, I certainly don't see myself as having that. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle. You can check out Michelle's writing at the Daily Beast Newsweek, where she is a contributing writer. And I want to make it clear, I do not think Michelle Goldberg is in any way responsible for making these Christian Dominionists just so popular. They're great. It's like they're... We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I will update you on that anonymous protest and this other shoe that has dropped at News Corp. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. So, last night, when I should have been spending time with my family, well, let me rephrase that. I was doing work. last night at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern time, Anonymous had called for, as I mentioned yesterday, a protest at the BART stations in San Francisco, specifically the Civic Center station, protesting what is now being investigated by the FCC as the illegal shutting down of cellular communications on the BART system by the BART's authority because they wanted to essentially prevent people from having an earlier protest of a shooting by BART policemen of what turns out to be, or is allegedly, an unarmed man. And Anonymous was protesting this methodology by BART to stop the protests. The State Department complains about it when Egypt shuts down cellular service. They complain about it, rightly, when Iran does it. When any other oppressive regime shuts down cellular service, this country is the first, maybe not the first, but pretty close to it, in condemning that action. You must allow protesters, at the very least, to communicate. And BART, in what I believe is the first instance of any government or quasi-government entity in this country, shut down cellular service. So Anonymous announced that they were going to protest. We mentioned this yesterday. And a protest they did. Now, it's unclear how many people actually turned out for the protest, but I'll tell you what, at 10 p.m. Eastern, this was posted. Well, it was actually posted. It's weird. The timestamp was 9:38, but it says 10 p.m. by the New York Times in their nuts and bolts or bites, whatever it was. And I had been watching this thing, and it was sort of slow to develop. And cops in full riot gear, a ton of cops, SWAT teams, multiple helicopters, were out for this protest. They first shut down the Civic Center stop, wouldn't let anybody off. You could see the trains go by because there were multiple cameras. Both ABC News or the local ABC had cameras there. And also some guys were on Quik. Some guys were on Ustream. And so you could see different angles of this. And somebody had posted the BART. You could basically get an iPhone app now where you can hear the BART cops police scanner. And so I was watching all these things simultaneously. And this guy, Nick Bilton, at 10 p.m. writes, Anonymous may be better at hacking than organizing a protest. More than a dozen members of the hacker group Anonymous joined a small group of San Francisco residents Monday evening to protest the fatal shooting of a 45-year-old man by police officers last month. I got news for you. There is video of ABC helicopters shooting. You can see hundreds of people moving after they closed down the Civic Center thing and basically shut people out. They slowly sort of push them out of the station. They go down, I think it was to the, I can't remember if it was the Mission one or with the next station. Then as soon as protesters get there, they shut that, and the protesters kept marching down to the next one. I mean, there were hundreds, and that's not a huge protest, but they did manage to essentially shut down three or four, at least, stops on the BART. I mean, it was an incredibly successful protest. I've been to anti-war rallies with 300,000-500,000 people that didn't get this type of coverage. And so I don't know what this guy was writing about. At 10 p.m., it was quite clear, even at 7:38 p.m. Pacific, that this was bigger than a dozen members of Anonymous and local residents. There were hundreds of people there. And to a certain extent, they were all members of Anonymous because there is no membership list. They joined it for the day, for the moment. And it was pretty stunning. I mean, I don't know how much mainstream media attention this has, but the FCC is looking into this. The EFF in the Electronic Frontier Foundation has already suggested that there were multiple laws broken by the actions of BART. And it's fascinating. It's just absolutely fascinating. And I think this is, and I've been saying this for months, since what we saw in Egypt, frankly, if you look around the world and you look at what's happened in the Arab Spring, you look at what's happened amongst Anonymous and Lulzsec, not the same things, but they are essentially people who are saying enough. They are rebelling in some form against the status quo. 300,000 people, as we talked about yesterday on this program, 300,000 people in Israel marching against privatization, marching against their governments. You have riots in the UK. You have tens of thousands of people in Spain protesting, 100,000 people protesting in Greece. And just starting this weekend, you will see hundreds, maybe more, of environmental protesters actually practicing civil disobedience. This was not a situation of civil disobedience. By the most part of this protest in San Francisco, nobody broke any laws. Some were arrested for not leaving a platform when they were told to. But this was not a civil, it was simply a protest movement. But folks, there's no denying this is the year of protest, as much as I think the establishment media doesn't want to talk about it. We'll see what happens next with this BART and with Anonymous, but fascinating stuff. That is my time, folks. I guess we're going to have to talk about this News Corp stuff in the post show. You can IM me at Majority FM. That other shoe that I had talked about yesterday, that the member of parliament, Tom Watson, suggested would drop today, has, as far as I can tell, dropped. I think these are the letters he's talking about. And as I dig through this reporting from The Guardian, there's one interesting nugget that may affect a media person in this country. Can you guess who I'm talking about? Not talking about Roger Ailes, not talking about Fox. But let me put it this way. The Murdochs, they're in trouble, folks. This is unraveling. It may not unravel in a day. It may take a couple of months. But you know that Rupert's sending out a lot of early Christmas cards. Don't forget what I remember you. Hey, I want some. We got some topless pictures of Jennifer Aniston on a beach in Greece I can send you. Please don't let me go to prison. It's the most humbling day of my life. We'll be right back. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call the program at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be back with your phone calls, your IMs, and a little bit more news.